their secret mountain lair somewhere in Colorado. This is the Image Doctors Photography Podcast with your hosts, Jason Odell and Rick Walker.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Image Doctors Photography Podcast. I'm Jason Odell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
Thanks for joining us again today. Good to see you again, Rick. Heard you had a little vacation this week. That was really
awesome. Yeah, it was just short, just 3 nights over on the western slope of Colorado, which is what Coloradans call the western part of the state, basically. And it was nice. My wife and I were there for an anniversary trip. And
oh, good.
We stayed in Glenwood Springs and went over to Colorado National Monument.
Nice.
Which I think is one of the most underrated places. It's just beautiful and, you know, has that look that you find in many of the really great Utah national parks.
Yes. Yes.
But it's just gorgeous. You know, I wasn't there at the optimum time of the day or anything like that, but it was nice and I had some fun doing some shooting.
Good.
And then we were also in Aspen and some of the surrounding areas there.
Oh, nice.
Nice as well.
Yeah, believe it or not, our listeners probably don't know this, but for 6 months when I first moved to Colorado, I was actually living on the Western Slope in Grand Junction. And so one of the spots that I first went to with my camera was Colorado National Monument. And I have photos of on transparencies, like Provia slides from there. It's really pretty. It's just a little difficult to shoot in there at what you would consider the optimum times for shooting.
Right.
Due to the way it's geographically arranged so that it's a little bit tough.
You can do both sunrise and sunset, but it's definitely more of a sunrise location with its orientation. I did not want to abuse my wife.
Yeah. Well, and then those trails require more of a hike in. You can't just drive the loop. The loop looks to the east, so that's an afternoon spot or an evening spot. Mm-hmm. But it's cool. There's hoodoos and all those neat rock formations. Mm-hmm. Western Colorado is really eastern Utah in terms of
topography,
geology, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's definitely because you're only like what 2 hours or an hour and a half from Moab at that point. So it's neat.
And at one point, we were over in Marble, Colorado, which is really quite close to where we'll be holding our next workshop in Crested Butte.
Right.
And just a reminder on that, people can see details on our Facebook page and on your website.
And we'll be having our little webinar tonight on that.
Yeah.
So if you're listening to this today, you can still sign up for our webinar.
At one point, just right over the ridge from there, and it was very green and pretty, and there were some smaller wildflowers starting to come up. So I think it'll be nice.
That is a good thing. That is a good thing. There's wildflowers popping up here locally too, because we're lower than the mountains. We're still high up, but it's been sunny. So I've been seeing some photos and some wildflower groups I belong to on Facebook. Folks are posting pictures, you know, where they found them, etc. There are things happening in our local area, not the massive blooms like you get in the mountains, but definitely pretty stuff. Lots of paintbrush and things are coming up. Well, that's cool. So what are we going to talk about today?
Well, two primary topics. First one will be a little bit of discussion about profiling displays and our thoughts on that compared to when we talked about it probably, I don't know, 10 years ago or so.
Yeah.
At least. And then we're just going to talk about a few accessories that we like that we've never discussed about before. Some are a little bit new, some are older, but we just haven't chatted about them and they're worth mentioning.
Cool. And so we'll have this sort of recurring topic in the larger scale. We're really talking about things like color management, but we're going to break it into different pieces. So today we'll just talk about sort of the fundamental underpinnings of why it's a thing you should be aware of at the very least. And you can decide on your own whether or not it's important for you. But you're right, it's changed a lot in the last 10 years, really, because of, mostly because of display technology.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a thing. So do you want to start talking about a little bit about color management first then?
Yeah, and you know, we'll save the heavier duty things for maybe a special episode, but you know, one of the really obvious things, you know, when you're editing an image on a screen is the screen needs to be showing you an accurate view of the image. If it's horribly shifted to blue or yellow, the way you're going to edit is going to try to counteract some of those shifts, and that might be throwing a color change into your image that should never be there. So other people look at it and go, wow, that's way too blue, or that's way too yellow, or that's too bright, or that's too dark.
Exactly. You know,
all of those kind of things. So the idea with profiling a display is you use this little hardware component that has its software that runs with your operating system, and it runs through a bunch of tests on color and everything, and then creates a profile coming out of it that is, you know, pretty accurate. And it's more important than people realize if they're not profiling a display at all. It can explain problems that you have printing, because you're not going to get a good print if your display was off and therefore your edits are off.
And that includes printing on services, not just at home.
Oh, like, absolutely. And if you're posting images online, again, it's going to avoid that problem of people looking at them and going, well, that looks a little bit weird. And I've seen that happen.
Mm-hmm. I've seen it too. You know, just I want to just kind of talk about that color shifting that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. You know, depending on the kind of display you have, depending on what it does, you know, depending on your computer's operating system, your display could be really weirdly color shifted. And the thing, but here's the thing: if you don't have a reference neutral gray, for example, to look at and compare, your brain will just eventually, after you look at your monitor, your brain will just accept whatever it is. If your monitor's bluish, your brain will just view that as a neutral color. And so mm-hmm. you're making adjustments to images that have a color cast in them, even though you don't notice it on your display. And that will cause you to adjust your images improperly to induce other color shifts, or like you said, brightness or darkness. Some mm-hmm. displays could be too dark. And you'll know this is happening when you send a photo to somebody, like, and they'll say, oh, this image is way too bright or way too dark or whatever. And it's because you are adjusting it based on your screen rather than a, you know, calibrated baseline. And so that's really important for a visual medium such as photography.
Yeah. And when I first started doing digital things, which originally were film scanning, mm-hmm. I did not have a calibrated monitor. I had an old CRT style mm-hmm. monitor. I mean, we're talking decades ago. And when I finally got around to calibrating the monitor and getting the device, I found it was horribly off. And oh, by the way, a lot of the work I had done on images was all for naught, because they looked awful to me after
right.
I got it calibrated and saw what they were really like. So I think it's a useful thing to do. Like you said, technology has changed and the calibration tools are better now, but also the displays are a lot better now.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what your thoughts are on it, but you know, it used to be that you really needed to reprofile your monitor periodically, you know, every couple of months, because they would drift.
Right. And this is very true with all of the old school CRT displays.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
the phosphors, things would fade or shift over time, and it just wouldn't, you know, if you measured your monitor. So I want to back up just a brief moment to talk about mm-hmm. what this calibration thing is. You touched on it. I want to just sort of throw in my two cents. What mm-hmm. you're doing with these little devices is that you're telling your what the software behind these tools is it sends a no a basically an RGB, you know, hexadecimal, whatever you want to call it, but a you know, computer code for a color. And it says monitor, produce this color, which let's say it's supposed to be red or blue, or, you know, something in between. And then the monitor puts that color on the screen to what it does. And this little device reads the actual color in the spectrum of what that really is. And so when you go through this whole process, and usually there's, you know, 100 and something patches of different color, you know, including grays and whites, and you do this, then what you get is essentially a description of almost like a glasses prescription for your display, which says, if I tell it to make, you know, if I give it this value, this is what comes out. So in order to get that, I need to, you know, translate it, if you will. It's almost like a Rosetta Stone where it says, okay, but your monitor, in order to produce red, I have to tell it to use this number, not the one that I thought, or whatever. And it also describes your monitor's range of colors that it can even produce. You know, like not all displays are created equal. There's some very expensive displays which will have a color range or gamut, they call it, that's very wide. And so it's able to display colors that your old CRT would never be able to produce. So knowing that is the critical piece, because not only does it give you a display that looks neutral on your screen, but then your other software programs will use that to make sure that what gets displayed on the screen and saved out elsewhere is correct and can be made into these standardized, what are called profiles. So it is like if you did one thing, right, calibrating your display would be that one thing that you should do. Like everything else would be, you know, extra at that point.
Now, I think the errors in monitors are lower than they used to be.
Definitely.
I've actually read some things where some people think if you use Apple monitors, for example, and we both use Apple computers, that you don't even need to calibrate your monitor. I would disagree with that. I can run my calibration tool and see what it looked like before and after. And while it's not as bad as it used to be in terms of a change, it's still absolutely making noticeable changes. So I don't believe that I think here's one of the unfortunate things in a way. There's not a lot of drift with the monitors.
Right.
The last time I calibrated my laptop monitor was about a year ago. And I've actually done it since, and it wasn't worth it. So I said, nah, I'm not even going to bother saving that.
Right.
It's not any different. So you're almost in a situation where you buy these things, you do it once, and you're almost done.
Right.
But it is a worthwhile thing.
It is. And you know, there's a variety of brands that, and they're not terribly expensive. You're talking something in the, you know, $150 range, which isn't cheap, but it's not painful. It is.
It's affecting how every single one of your images ends up looking to others or in a print or things like
that. Right. So what I've learned over the years was that when I moved from, so flat panel displays were better, but they have different illumination sources. So they used to be illuminated with like fluorescent tubes with you know, the back lighting. Now it's LED lights, and so LEDs just don't drift. When I look at my monitor on my 2013 vintage laptop and I look at its profile, now its profile just sort of is, you know, again, it's a translation for software to use, but you can kind of look at the space, the number of the range of colors that it's able to produce. My 2013 MacBook Pro produces a much narrower range of colors than my 2015 Retina iMac. And then I just got a new laptop, which brand new, you know, one of the new MacBook Pros that uses, you know, the newest Apple display. And it has, you know, even wider color gamut. So we can talk about those spaces, and you'll hear things referred to as sRGB and Adobe RGB, and you know.
And we'll save that for a future.
Yeah, but those are just containers that you know hold a range of colors, and the idea is that you know you hope that your monitor can at least produce, you know, close to one of those ranges, so that not only is your editing better, you can just see more shades of you know tones on your screen. But that when you output to stuff and share that work or print that work, it's going to be reproduced reasonably well.
Yeah.
You know, so that's, we'll talk about color spaces and color profiles sort of later. But yeah, I mean, if you, and so which calibration tool are you currently using?
Yeah, the one I have is a, I'm not sure if it's a Spider X or Spider 10. It's one of those two.
And that's SPYDER.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have,
and it works well.
I have an X-Rite I1 display, which is pretty small, and it works well. And I got it because it can be used to profile things like projectors, although I found that to be a little bit of a mess. It can be tricky at times, but I've used it, and I think I found the same thing. I rerun the calibration because, oh, I haven't done that in 2 years. And then it comes back, and it looks like exactly, you know, when you see the little color map, it looks almost the same. It doesn't have a significant change. But it is like, and the nice thing about all of these devices is that the software that they include is practically step by, I mean, it walks you right through the, you know,
it's easy.
Do this, click this, adjust the brightness on your screen. You know, it just takes you through the necessary things because it's measuring your screen brightness. So you can dial in all that stuff, and then it just runs its thing, and it creates a profile, and it saves it to your computer, and you're done. And that's it.
Yeah.
It's super easy.
Yeah.
So we'll talk more about how we use those profiles in sort of real world circumstances in a future episode.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about some accessories that we like that we haven't discussed before. A
couple of cool little things.
Yeah, I can go first if you want.
Sure. Because I think the one you have, we both use.
Oh, one of them.
Yeah.
That I was going to mention.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other one I was going to mention first, which is it was the bag that I took with me on the trip I was just talking about.
Oh, okay, cool.
And it's actually been discontinued now.
Oh, bummer.
This isn't a brand new thing. I've had it for a little while, but we've never chatted about it. But it's a MindShift Exposure 13 shoulder bag. And, you know, the 13 comes from the 13-inch laptop compartment that it has. But it's just a nice shoulder bag that is very weather resistant. It's made out of sailcloth, which means it repels water well. You can just wipe it off with a washcloth if it gets dirty. It's very lightweight. And what I like about it is if I'm doing a shoot where I'm mostly operating out of a car, but I'm just, you know, walking, let's say, on the order of several hundred feet, maybe 1,000 feet or so to a shooting location, you know, a backpack is kind of unnecessary and slower to operate out of. This is quick, and it also has pretty good sized compartments in it. It's efficient. You can actually put a Holy Trinity set of lenses and camera in there very easily. So it's a nice one. Like I said, it's been discontinued now, but you can certainly find them on eBay and shoulder bags or bags of any type, or just about the lowest risk thing that you can imagine buying on eBay.
So right. it's a mind shift.
Yeah, it's a MindShift Exposure 13. There's also a 15 that'll hold a 15-inch laptop, but I think that one is a little bit bulky. This is a little bit nicer size. Mm-hmm. So I would recommend it.
Definitely comes down to what your use is. And I find shoulder bags are best when I know I'm either going light and I'm not really transporting a ton of gear, and I want to be able to work out of them easily without having to put things down all the time. And that's when shoulder bags work really well, whereas backpacks are better for, okay, I've got to carry my stuff kind of a long way and it might be heavy or through an airport or whatever. And that works. So it's a different thing. And as you know, we have a couple of different ones.
Oh yeah. Now you've used a little gizmo. I haven't tried it. That looks kind of clever for reducing dust and dirt on this sensor.
Well, you know, I was chatting with our good friend Vincent Versace, you know, Nikon mm-hmm. ambassador and everything. And this is not a Nikon thing, but it happens to work with that. And he told me about this, and he says, you got to check out these filters. I'm like, what are you talking about? Because, like, you know, Vincent, you've always told me that I shouldn't put a filter on the, you know, filters can be, you know, degrade your image, right? He goes, no, this one is totally different. So I said, okay, I'll go check this out. And this is from Case or Kase. I don't know how you pronounce it. It might be German. It's Kase. And it's a clip-in camera filter for mirrorless cameras. So this filter is clear, and they make neutral density ones, but that's not what this is. This is just a multi-coated UV filter. Now, we both don't, neither of us use UV filters for protection on our lenses, you know, for a lot of reasons, but this is different. So this is just intended to be a clear filter, and it clips in to your lens mount underneath the lens, you know, inside, in this case, the F mount of my Nikon. They make them for other mirrorless brands as well. And it goes, and it sits about, I don't know.
Or Z mount, right?
Yeah, or a Z mount, right. It sits maybe less than a quarter of an inch from the sensor itself, and it extends mm-hmm. beyond the edge of the sensor. So when it's mounted on there, you effectively have a dust filter for your sensor.
And so it doesn't affect your ability to attach lenses or
no, anything it's sitting like inside, that.
You
it's underneath
it in there and pretend it's not there, right?
Exactly. It just sits there. And so when we went to Oregon a couple of weeks ago, I had just installed. So I made sure I got all the dust out of my sensors. But what's nice about this is if I do need to take a brush, because there is a speck of dust somewhere, I'm brushing this filter, not the sensor. So step one is make sure your sensor's clean and then install it. But it was super easy to install. It just clips in. There's no mounting hardware. There's nothing. It just attaches via tension. And it doesn't affect the image quality as far as I can say.
Well, I have to believe one thing that would be an advantage with it too is, as long as it doesn't degrade the image, and from all the little tests you've done, it sounded to me like it wasn't doing that. But it also, if there's dust that gets on it, it's further away from the sensor, which mm-hmm. means it's less likely to show up in your image.
Right.
At the very least, it'll be, you know, very soft and diffuse rather than hard right. and distracting.
And when I saw dust on one of my cameras, I realized it was because I hadn't cleaned the, it was underneath the filter, and I popped it out, blew out the sensor, put the filter back on. But, you know, it's reassuring knowing that if I did need to, you know, do a cleaning of some, you know, using a brush or whatever you use mm-hmm. to clean that, I can just clean the filter and not touch my sensor. And then it just keeps the dust off the sensor as well. So presumably, I mean, it's not like hermetically sealed. There's no gaskets or anything like that. But my right. guess is it's going to do a pretty good job of keeping dust out when you're changing lenses or keeping dust off your sensor. It doesn't keep dust out of your camera, but it keeps it off the sensor. So when you do go around and change lenses, it can be a lot easier to deal with.
Yeah. All right. So we'll.
So it's
we'll
kind of neat.
Yeah, we'll put a link to it in the notes for the show that show up on.
Yeah,
Facebook,
I think I bought it at B&H or something. I don't remember exactly how much I paid.
And it's not Nikon only. It's made for differing camera
right.
mounts.
Right. I think they have it for Olympus cameras. Or and possibly Canon Sony. And, I can't remember. But yeah. but it yeah, you just choose the flavor of mount you want. And if it exists, it's there. So,
but it's mirrorless. It's not intended for DSLRs. The mirror would be right in the way.
Yeah, you can't do that. Okay, and then there's one other thing that that we both use.
Yep,
right?
And we've used them for a while, and they're great. Do you want to mention it?
Well, I mean, this is another one of these MindShift products. So MindShift is a subsidiary, or they were a separate brand from Think Tank, but they're really made by the same company, and now they're all on the same site. So if you go to Think Tank Photo, you can see the mm-hmm. MindShift stuff. And this is a filter case. It's called the Filter Nest Mini.
Mm-hmm.
It holds four filters up to about 82 millimeter diameter ring mount yep. filters. And it's just nice. And it's a little filter wallet. It's compact. It can fit in this, you know, a slot in your bag. And it's 99% of the time, it's all the filters that I need to take are in that one little case, and it's there. And I can take it out of the bag and then work from it if I need to.
Mm-hmm. I actually have several of these, and you know, I'll have a set of 77 millimeter filters, you know, like ND filters, polarizers. Mm-hmm. I have another one that has 82 millimeter ones in it. Mm-hmm. I have another one that has, you know, some fancy polarizers, you know, the three stop and six stop ones, mm-hmm. and other things, and step up rings. But the, you know, like you said, they're great. They fit in other bags very easily. It's a good way to organize stuff. They don't weigh much at all.
Oh yeah, it's nothing.
Yeah, so I would recommend them. They're just great. And if you have multiple bags, it makes it easy to move your filters around between
them. Yeah, it means you've got all your filters in one easy to grab and go compartment, and you're not relying on you know, a lot of times filters, they come in these big plastic protective cases, right? Mm-hmm. And you start stacking all of those in your bag, they're everywhere. So this is one little thing. So I in mine, I've got my typical set, 82 millimeter, I've got polarizer, and then 5, 10, and 15 stop ND ring mount, and that's my filters. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. when I need them, and in fact, if I'm wearing a vest or something, I just put it in the pocket of the vest.
Right.
Works nicely. So that's cool stuff. So if you've got suggestions for things that you like, we'd love to hear those suggestions. Send us a note over at facebook.com/imagedoctors. You could also leave a comment on my website where we host this podcast, luminescentphoto.com. But we'll have more color management tips coming up in the future, plus other things, of course, that we brainstorm up in the next week. We look forward to hopefully seeing some of you guys in Colorado with us in July. And until next time, happy shooting.
All right. Bye-bye.